Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Today on The Charlie Kirk Show, I want to air an interview of where I'm getting interviewed, not just the one doing the interviewing. You guys are really going to enjoy this long-form discussion I had with London Real. We talk about tech tyranny, Google, and all sorts of big pressing issues around President Trump and the future of America. It's one of the most in-depth conversations I've had a chance to have in quite some time. I think you guys are going to really enjoy it. Before we get started, email me, freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. And if you guys want to get involved with Turning Point USA, go to tpusa.com. That's tpusa.com. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Charlie, I am very excited to have you here today. You recently said that there are four branches of the government, and the fourth is called Silicon Valley, and they're stronger than the rest of them. Maybe you can give me a little perspective on the fight we've been battling lately. I mean, until 8 weeks ago, I was the darling of YouTube, and now we're literally one strike away from being deplatformed, all from having calm conversations that don't encourage violence, destruction of property, and yet we're still being censored. What are your thoughts on this, Charlie?
Well, look, this is now one of the biggest issues in Western civilization. Look, the founding fathers, they wrote extensively about how they were worried about power, centralized power. That's why I'm a conservative. And now in recent years, we're starting to ask ourselves the question, is there a power that is growing that is potentially bigger than the federal government that actually might have more centralized capacity to influence public opinion or be able to have positive or negative sort of influences on society? And so you look at Google, for example, and you mentioned YouTube, they have the power to be able to topple a government. 90%+ of all search results go through Google. And it's interesting because a lot of our monopoly laws were written in the early 1900s for a completely different type of monopoly, for a monopoly that would have had vertical monopolization and would have been exploiting people on prices. This is different. This is something that could potentially be culturally exploitative, that could be linguistically or politically exploitative. And so this is happening much quicker than people realize. And so there's a collision happening right now in the conservative movement. I think it's a healthy one where there's some people that say we should do nothing. I think that's a mistake. People say that, oh, just let free market principles play itself out. I'm not of the opinion that is going to act. First of all, I don't believe there's actually a free market in tech right now. I think that's actually not an honest observation of how these tech companies operate. And secondly, I think you need to look more broadly at the power that these tech giants actually hold, whether it be in the political space, their ability to make people, they essentially hold the power to digitally assassinate somebody. And so I want you to understand the power of that. If I told you that someone's existence, the amount of time they spend on the phone. So if someone's watching this right now, go to your screen time on either your iPhone or your Android or your device. If it's more than 5 hours or 6 hours a day, then your identity is mostly through your device. And so if a tech company has the ability just to assassinate you and disappear you, are they not getting rid of an aspect of you? And so there's a lot of questions about what does this look like public policy-wise and philosophically. But I'm of the opinion that when you have the traditional three branches of government and you have the fourth branch of government, which is the unelected, unknown, unchecked power of the bureaucracies, but even more so than the bureaucracies, you have these tech giants in Silicon Valley. And not every one of these companies are equally as abusive. I want to make that very clear. They're all different degrees. Twitter is perplexing at how aggressive they've been in recent days, fact-checking the president using Washington Post literature while completely ignoring the tyrants of the Chinese Communist Party, Google going after individuals such as yourself. Facebook has very questionable decisions they've made on their government oversight board of censorship and this new fact-checking process. But I will say with Facebook, I can get a human being on the phone within an hour at Facebook, and I can give you examples of actually how they have communicated with me and actually admitted that they've done some things not so well. Whether that will continue or not will remain to be seen. But Google and Twitter right now, they are on a very dangerous path to basically say they want to be a leftist company. They want to be a leftist, anti-conservative, anti-free speech company. And that's something that should concern everyone watching this, regardless of your political persuasion or affiliation.
Yeah, like you said, a lot of these monopoly laws were kind of made, you know, against the steel industry or the banking industry or, you know, different types of industry that didn't actually control information. And, you know, it's funny, when I'm out on the streets, I just bumped into a mother and daughter who recognized me, and they came up and said, you know, we believe in what you're saying. We want to hear this information. But, you know, on the streets, you hear that with real people. But when you go online, there's a whole different version of what's happening. You know, again, I'm being censored. I'm being said I'm this or that. And like you said, my identity can kind of get hijacked by a couple companies that kind of dominate search. You know, it's funny. I had Candace Owens on last week, and she mentioned DuckDuckGo. I never had actually heard of that search engine. And she was saying, I was actually Googling how many black people in the world, and I got all of these articles about how coronavirus was hurting black people more and all this stuff. And she's like, I was just trying to get this, but I was served up this whole other agenda of information. And I think, like you said, we forget how much of our human experience is digital, and then it's actually controlled by a few.
Yeah, and so that's a phenomenal point. And so we have to ask ourselves the question also about intellectual property. So for example, I've been on Twitter. I was one of the first users of Twitter, percentage-wise, not in aggregate, but I started using Twitter in 2011. Okay, so that's pretty early. I think that's fair to say, more so than most. I was a junior in high school when I first heard about Twitter. I happened to watch the Ellen DeGeneres show, of which I haven't made a habit out of that. But I was watching Ellen DeGeneres show as a junior in high school, and I remember they're talking about this new platform called Twitter. I remember exactly the class. I remember the seat I was sitting in the computer tech class, third period of school, and I started the Twitter account. And so I've poured my life and soul over 9 years into that Twitter account. I'm talking about tens of thousands of hours of my work, my productivity, my thoughts, my dreams on that Twitter account. That's not Twitter. That's me. So if Twitter decides to delete my Twitter today, which they could do, I hope they don't. I have 1.7 million Twitter followers. My Twitter followers have completely stagnated. We were gaining 10,000 Twitter followers every couple of days on Twitter. And now we've basically flatlined since the virus because we've said some things that have, you know, essentially challenged the status quo. And so now let's say Twitter decides to ban me. I hope they don't. All of a sudden that 9 years of work goes where? There's actually precedent in property law to say that you as an individual, when you pour yourself into creating something that is yourselves, you should have the rights to that intellectual property. Why is Twitter able to just delete all the unique thoughts and all the unique takes and all the unique videos, all the unique commentary that I put on their platform over the last 9 years? Now they could say, well, that's our platform. You voluntarily consented to it. That's actually not that cut and dry and simple. For example, first of all, they monetized my speech. They make money off of me, okay? And they did not pay me a royalty. So there's an argument there. But also, if I own 10,000 acres of land in rural Montana, and someone actually comes onto my piece of property and builds a cabin, over a period of time, if I don't challenge them and I just let them do that, there's actually, it's similar to squatters' rights, that after a period of time, the court will say, no, that's their cabin now. They built it. They poured into it. That's theirs because you didn't challenge them. And so that might be a little bit too kind of distant in the legal community to actually have any merit because of the power of Twitter's, you know, access to legal expertise. But I'll tell you, there's something to that because I have, for example, I'll get over 130,000 retweets on a single day, 130,000 on a single day. That's not insignificant. That's what some people will get over the course of their entire Twitter existence. I will reach about 100 million people on Twitter a day. Twitter needs people like me. I'm a content creator. Now, I'm not going to play victim. I benefit from it too, make no mistake. I'm not one of those people that wants to just completely bite the hand that's feeding me. I have benefited from these platforms. But at some point, they have to treat me not as just someone that is the complete and total enemy, but as someone that is actually someone who's feeding them what they need. They need thousands of Charlie Kirks to perform on their platform to be able to have them to be a monetized company and be the multi-billion dollar company that they are.
Yeah, this is something I've been thinking a lot about. I had a conversation with YouTube 12 days ago, And honestly, it was after we had had a strike, which meant for 7 days we were not allowed to upload or go live. And the reps basically said, you make one small move and you're gone. As in, we won't even give you another strike. You'll just be off. And I've been on there 9 years, 8,000 videos, including 5 documentary films, 250 million views, another 250 million views on YouTube from my content that people have ripped. My whole life is on there. I mean, I told them, I mean, I got emotional on the call. It's like, it's my life. And I literally meet people on the streets and our content has literally saved their life. I didn't believe it at first, but they're like, I was on the brink of suicide. I was in divorce. I was addicted to drugs. And like, I saw one of your guests and they said the right thing at the right time. So I know what you mean. You know, it's this creator, but it's just more than that. It's also, it's more than just some videos as well. And yet they were ready to do that because I published some videos that violated their community policy, which is a private company they say they can have. I argued that it was so subjective that I was literally living in terror. That's what I said. I said, I feel like I'm being terrorized because I don't know when you're going to come and find a video from 3 years ago and tell me it's hate speech. One of the guys was a big fan of Priyanka Chopra. She's a famous Bollywood actress. And I was talking on the phone. He said, I love your interview with Priyanka. I said, what if in minute 43, she says, I hate Hollywood directors? Like, you could come back tomorrow and say, I just violated community and now I've been deplatformed. I said, this is what I live in. And as a creator, it doesn't feel right. And yet they go back to this private company thing, which I agree, it doesn't hold water on a lot of ways.
But let me build that out, the private company thing. And so let's just look from a public perception standpoint. Let's take an American company that people know that it's owned by conservatives, Home Depot. So Home Depot is owned by a couple, you know, founded by a couple conservatives. What if Home Depot said, if you wear a Biden hat or a Democrat hat, you're not allowed to shop at Home Depot? How do you think people would react to that? Now, they'd have a right to do it. It's a private company. But do you think that that would be tolerated? I mean, so let's use another example. Let's use American Airlines. Let's say if American Airlines said that if you open up your app and you read the Huffington Post, or if you have a newspaper that is the New York Times, you're not allowed to board American Airlines planes. Do you think that would stand up in a court of law? Be interesting. I don't think so. And I don't think the public pressure would apply. So why is it that all of a sudden that these tech companies are getting away with censoring us? And so there's a couple ways that this is going to happen. I'm going to tell you the bad way that this could happen. The bad way is if the left gets control of this and they want to turn this into a public utility where they deem what is fair and not. That is worse than what's even happening now. Let me just put a danger out there. Elizabeth Warren wants to nationalize these companies, and so does Bernie Sanders, because it'll be 10 times worse than what's happening now. They'll have some sort of nonsense social justice warrior, college professor board of anti-American, anti-Western people that will not even give you 3 strikes. They'll be worse than the tyrants that are running these companies right now. Now, what I think that might be actually more interesting is to get the Department of Justice involved under AG Barr and say, is platform access a civil right? And I think you could make that argument. And I'm not totally 100% behind this idea because I see some traps in it, but I'm very open to it. Do you have a civil right to be able to use the place where all public discussion is happening? So for example, you're able to petition your government and you're able to get the right to say whatever you want outside of the US Capitol or the Supreme Court. You're able to fill out that form. And even if you're the worst aspects of society, you're able to get that form of petition. Okay, why can't you do that on YouTube? You can make an argument that you're really not going to have as much of an influence outside of the Capitol to influence and have the First Amendment rights in our Constitution as you are able to have actually access to where 92% of all search results are on YouTube. That is by and far away, not even close, to the number one video provider on the planet. Facebook is probably second or third. So why wouldn't we be able to have that constitutional right? When people say, well, they're not bound by the First Amendment. But again, there's plenty of private companies that would not be able to discriminate based on viewpoint. They just wouldn't. I want you to imagine right now if Chipotle or McDonald's said that Democrats are not able to come and shop at, you know, not able to purchase product at our store. That would not hold up. They'd say that's that's against discrimination. They would use all sorts of different precedent. Well, why are these tech companies immune to that? And so then, of course, there's the Section 230, the Communications Decency Act. I wrote a piece for the Washington Post, of all places, that published this. Kudos to them for actually publishing it, and demerits to them for everything they've done since. But I'll tell you that, look, it provides immunity from liability for them, for providers and users. There's something to that. And I've heard very thoughtful rebuttal to it. They say, oh, Charlie, that's not enough. But this is headed in a very, very, very dangerous direction where you have these tech companies that are acting like Stalinists. that they are going to stamp out opinion that they don't like. And I want to differentiate the tech companies again. Twitter and Google have just been awful. Facebook has some very troubling trends, but I'll give you an example of Facebook. Now, whether or not this will continue or not, I don't know. They censored one of my posts last week through one of their very puzzling fact-checking funding enterprises through Reuters. They said, this is untrue. It was so bad. I contacted Facebook and I said, please look into this. This is Reuters doing activist journalism. Within 12 hours, Facebook removed the censor. Good for them. Now, it took a lot of my time, a lot of my energy. I can't get a human being to respond to me at Twitter. And so we had one of our individuals, ALX, that works for us at Turning Point USA. His name's Alex LaRusso, 24-year-old kid, one of the nicest people ever meet in your entire life, 100,000 followers on Twitter, followed by the president, retweeted by the president. And Twitter just decided to disappear him, similar to a Wuhan scientist. Just, we're going to get rid of him. And his whole digital identity is gone. Years of work. I appealed. I reached out directly to Jack. And I don't know what's going on there. Do they just want to become a pseudo-Stalinist tech company? Is that their new approach? Or do they want to represent our country? Just represent all viewpoints of our country, I think is a more proper way to say it. So look, this is one of the biggest issues of our time. This is something that if we fail to address it and recognize it, we are going to have a subset of private companies that have more power than our government. Therefore, they run our country. And it's fair to say that most people at these tech companies hate everything we stand for. They hate free expression. They're postmodernists, anti-American, anti-Western, anti-God believing individuals that are on an activist-driven campaign to stamp out people that they disagree with.
Well, it's been fascinating being on the other end of it, you know. Until 2 months ago, I just heard about people that experienced this, and now I'm experiencing it. And again, if you walked into Chipotle and they said, if you don't agree with the vaccination agenda, we won't serve you, they couldn't do that. If you're, if you disagree that maybe a mask should be worn to protect you against COVID-19, we won't serve you, they wouldn't do that. And again, there is precedent for this. If you had a, you know, if you had a diner in the South in the 50s and you might have said, oh, our policy is to refuse to serve black people. Was that okay? It actually wasn't okay. And so we made sure that it was enforced. So,
and just really quick, the way they would respond to that, though, is that a Civil Rights Act, racial discrimination, whereas this is preference and viewpoint discrimination. And it's a distinction without a difference, but you're exactly right that there is precedent of law. For example, that there is precedent now that these private companies will be under the Department of Justice and their power if you don't, in certain states, subscribe to their gender identity persuasion codes. And so, wait, that doesn't make any sense. And so then people say, well, a restaurant is not a platform. It's not under the Communications Decency Act. Well, maybe, but how is that any different than saying you don't, how is it any different than saying like you can't go on to this airline and you have this certain perspective? I like the airline example because there's only three of them, basically. There's United, Delta, and American Airlines. And there's so few of them that no one would be able to say that airlines would be able to discriminate based on viewpoint. And as long as you are within the code of what the airline deems to be acceptable behavior and you're not screaming, you're not outlandish, you're able to board that airline. And so, look, there's a lot happening here. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I apologize for that. It triggered that thought. So.
Are you guys being crushed by the cartel of the colleges? Well, to get people with student loan debt out of student loan debt, that's why Credible is there. Credible is an online marketplace that gets you pre-qualified student loan refinancing rates from up to 10 different lenders. They help people get out of student loan debt. If you've got student loan debt, you could benefit. With a lower rate, you could save on interest or lower your monthly payment. And with a shorter loan term, you could get debt-free faster. You can consolidate all your student loans in one place. Incredible customers have given awesome reviews about how much better their lives have been after refinancing their student loans. You might not have student loan debt, but if your friend does, your son, your daughter, your grandson or granddaughter, you can go to Credible.com/Charlie. That's Credible.com/Charlie. On Credible, you see actual pre-qualified rates from up to 10 different lenders, whereas with some other marketplaces, other online marketplaces that won't be named, you'll get ranges of rates or ballpark estimates. It only takes a couple minutes to check rates, and checking rates does not impact your credit. They never sell your data, so you will not receive spam and phone calls from dozens of lenders. So please visit Credible.com/Charlie. That's CREDIBLE.com/CHARLIE. When you refinance using that link, they'll give you $200. Credible.com/Charlie.
What do you think of the move we just seen that Joe Rogan made by going to Spotify? I mean, at first we heard the headlines of the cash that was involved, you know, the $100 million deal. But then when you dug deeper, you could hear that one of the reasons was that he felt he was being censored on YouTube. He specifically called out YouTube and Twitter in the Barry Weiss article in the New York Times. And, you know, we know he stopped live streaming a year ago. That was curious to me. And now he's potentially going to Spotify where they're going to not have that censorship. Is there a capitalistic way around this where new platforms will come up? Or is YouTube getting the message? Or is it such a big monopoly that we're not convinced that'll happen?
So the answer is both. We have to look for external solutions. I'm a huge Joe Rogan fan. I don't see eye to eye on him with a lot of different things, especially his drug usage. Happy to talk to him about that. But I think he's brilliant. I think he's one of the best communicators, best interviewers of our time. He has a way about him that makes it feel as if you're eavesdropping in on a private conversation. And I also just love the over-masculinity of his entire show, that I'm going to own the fact that I am an alpha male, and if you don't like it, don't watch it. I'm actually in the minority opinion. I think that he's undervalued in that deal. I think he's worth way more than $100 million. I think Spotify got the better deal out of it. If it's true that he's going to just put all of his content exclusively on Spotify, including streaming rights, I mean, you look at an average Rogan video, it'll get 3 to 4 million YouTube views, which is extraordinary. You go back in the archives with Elon Musk, because Elon Musk interview just on his channel, not even the reposting of it, got 38 million views on YouTube. I mean, these are astronomical numbers, not to mention he's getting 150 million downloads a month on Apple Podcasts. So I would actually think $100 million is lowballing. Now, I guess that's $100 million for the rights of it. He's still going to get ad revenue and royalties, so maybe there's something baked into it. But good for him. I think it was less about the money in the mind of Joe Rogan and more about he actually has internalized a lot of his guests coming on his show that have said that, Joe, you realize that the more you use these platforms, the more you're giving them fodder to be able to censor all of these dissident voices that you are highlighting. And I think Joe Rogan made a very philosophical and moral and courageous stand by saying, you know what, why don't I go to an external platform that might shake this up a little bit? And good for him. Because in his conversation, very informal with, I think it was Barry Weiss that wrote the New York Times opinion, who's one of the very few thoughtful people at the New York Times. She's terrific. I don't agree with her on everything, but she's a very good writer. She had an exclusive interview with him. It was a very long article in the Times where Rogan basically said, look, it's about time they stop censoring us. And I'm looking forward to now this kind of shaking up the status quo. Now, whether or not YouTube realizes this or they just think they're so big and so monolithic they can't be disrupted remains to be seen. But I think we have to take it from a couple different angles. And again, I don't think the monopoly angle is going to work, and they know that. Our monopoly laws, the Sherman Antitrust Act was written, I think, in 1907 for the very specific purpose of breaking up Standard Oil, and Andrew Carnegie had a completely different type of monopoly that was trying to vertically monopolize and trying to exploit consumers, allegedly exploit consumers. That's not what they're doing. They're instead using the quote-unquote free usage model where you're actually the product. You're not the user. You're the product. They're selling you to the company. They're selling your consumer purchasing. They're selling your search history. You're not the user. You've become the thing that's actually on the assembly line for these tech companies, which is what is so different. And so I think if we're going to create new legislation, I'm careful to take the recommendations of the tech companies. Let me say this. These tech companies come to DC. They hire the best lobbyists on the planet and they say, oh, regulate us. Bad idea. If a company ever tells you to regulate them, they're writing the regulation that's going to benefit them and prevent a Spotify from ever being a competitive YouTube. So Spotify, they gained $1.3 billion in market value and market cap once they signed Joe Rogan. Awesome. Good for them. That shows that the market realizes the significance. So they got 10 times the market. No, I'm sorry, 13 times the market cap value based on just the signing equivalent of what they got from Rogan. So again, that proves the point that Spotify got the better deal in this whole Rogan thing, at least on the monetary side of it. But YouTube is going to come under a lot of fire legislatively if they continue on this path. And so I think the best way to go about this is go to the point of regulation that YouTube disagrees with most, platform access. Maybe there's something to be said that you as a human being get a social security number equivalent to the Social Security Administration, and you're not allowed to be deaffiliated from that platform equivalent to your social security number. Maybe that's a solution. Now, there's a counter argument to be said, but what if they say the most vile, racist, horrible, awful things in society? Well, we allow them to protest outside of the Capitol, right? We allow those awful, horrible people to have a platform outside of the Capitol. And we've actually done a good job of saying more speech is the better solution to that. Now, I'm not saying this is a perfect solution, because there is something to be said that vile, awful, horrible people should be given the capacity to be cross-examined. And sometimes in a social media setting, you can't be cross-examined. But I'm not convinced that that's a good reason to shut up the entire half of Western society. And so, look, there's never any good perfect answers. We have to admit that. We're just in a very bad answer right now, and a very dangerous one, and a very Stalinist direction right now. If you study the 20th century, it's riddled with once free societies embracing authoritarian tyrants to shut up people they disagree with. And usually it's done through government. The difference right now, it's done through private companies. And what's different about this, and you mentioned this earlier, who's more powerful right now? The 100 people that work at Google right now, or the 100 people at the IRS? Now, some people would traditionally say in the conservative circles, 100 people at the IRS, for sure. Maybe. But do you know what the difference at the IRS is? I can hire an attorney. I can cross-examine them. I can bring them in front of a judge and maybe a jury of my peers and show that the IRS is unfairly targeting me. I can sue them back and I can win. It's hard. It's expensive. I can't do that with Google. In fact, it's proven to be futile. I can't win because they just hide behind the Communications 230 Decency Act, as I mentioned earlier. So I actually think they're more powerful. The IRS can't topple a government. The IRS doesn't even know where I am right now. Google knows exactly where I am. They claim they don't abuse it and look at it. Nonsense, rubbish. That's foolishness. Edward Snowden showed us that people that have the power to abuse it will abuse it. Now, I'm not a huge fan of Edward Snowden for other reasons, but that's a different conversation for a different time. I think there's good and bad that come out of all things. I think Edward Snowden was more of a societal teacher more than anything else, despite I'm not a big believer in leaking private information that is given through NSA. But to close the point, I'll say this. We have to look at where the power is. And we, as people that are skeptical of power, read the Federalist Papers, read Jefferson, read Locke. They hated centralized power. If we hate centralized power, then we shouldn't love a company that's more powerful than our government. Isn't that a logical way to explain it? And just because they're technically an LLC or they're technically a publicly traded company doesn't make them good. And this is a philosophical divergence sometimes in the conservative movement, where all of a sudden we've looked as government automatically bad, private company automatically good. That's generally true. I think that's generally a true rule. But there's exceptions, and I think this is the broad exception, especially when these companies are staffed with the worst elements of American society. Anti-American Marxists that are trained by university professors that want to topple us from within, that have a deconstructionist anti-Western philosophy, that are committed to taking us down at all costs. I'm not willing to do nothing.
With currently no NBA, NHL, or Major League Baseball, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be terribly wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of events, and guess what? NBA is coming back. It's coming back, so you guys have got to get involved with BetOnline.ag. If you miss the NFL, no problem. BetOnline still has daily Madden NFL 20 simulations you can wager on, and NASCAR is officially back. If you're into entertainment betting, that's okay. You can still bet on stock prices, the weather, and even the Nathan's hot dog eating contest. If you are an MMA fan, UFC 250 is coming up on June 7th. Make sure to stay tuned to this podcast to hear former MMA star Shael Sonnen and BetOnline's Dave Mason to talk all things UFC's 250, including all the latest betting lines. They're all open 24 hours a day and all online. Visit the website or use your mobile device and join today to receive your new welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online wagering solution. Visit betonline.ag. Don't forget that promo code podcast1 for your sign-up bonus. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about what you see in professors and what you see when you go into these schools. And I want to get into the book as well. Look, I appreciate your thoughts on these platforms, and I do think we're going in the right direction with what Rogan did. Honestly, I feel like, you know, even that move alone might have kept us on YouTube for now, just by knowing that there's a wave here and they need to be careful of public sentiment. So, to be continued on that. Let me get your thoughts on the last 8 to 10 weeks. I know you're in Arizona. You've been locked down. What do you see? What's happened with the coronavirus, the lockdown, everything that you see coming? You famously had a bunch of tweets retweeted by the president a few weeks ago, who obviously was feeling the same way you were feeling. What's Charlie Kirk's read?
I'm more of a president. I'm a more supporter of a president today than I ever have been. I'm more supporter of the president today than I ever have been. Let me be more specific in my language. He's done a phenomenal job here. He's been in a very difficult position. With that being said, I've been very, very critical of these lockdowns. And I think it's important to realize the president was never advocating vocally for lockdowns. He put forth guidelines and he left it to the states. More broadly, though, I think the lockdowns are going to go down as one of the worst decisions in American history. And I think the president agrees with that. The president said that we can't let the cure be worse than the virus. He retweeted me saying that early in March, by the way, early on in this process. I think that we were lied to by a lot of these governors. We were lied to by the Imperial College model. People need to go to jail for what they did. The data and the modeling has proven to be incorrect. And let me just build this out a little bit more. We've never even seen the code that's gone into these modeling that we shut down entire society for. Do you know that the data has still not been made transparent? We've still not seen the input variables that were used, where they said that there could be 2.2 million deaths. 2.2 million deaths. I would have shut down America if those models were put in front of me. My goodness, are you kidding me? 2.2 million deaths? Now, I was more skeptical from the outside because I know that this quote-unquote expert community and the hysteria mob in the scientific consensus community that does nothing but tries to create clickbait modeling, they're not actually always rooted in the best interest of our country. They're rooted in what's the best interest of getting them attention and shutting down Western society. I'm afraid that this was a trial run for a police state. I'm afraid that what was happening right now was how far can we push the boundaries? What is America's breaking point? And these people that are now acting surprised, oh, we didn't know it was going to happen. Well, you must have no understanding of 20th century history. I mean, the 20th century is a bloodbath. And the bloodbath started with lockdowns, when people couldn't leave their home and express themselves and be free, when the government told you exactly what to do and how to do it. And that's why I was inherently skeptical from the very beginning. And from an epidemiological perspective, I thought the Grand Princess cruise ship was actually the most instructive piece of data. And I wasn't alone in that. And then I asked the question, well, why don't we just use that as a starting point and see if that's wrong? Instead, we decided to shut down all of Western society and then find out about the virus. That wasn't right. We now have 37 million people out of work in the States. We now have an economy that's going to take a lot of effort to rebuild. Again, the president empowered states, and you saw states like South Dakota and Governor Noem do heroic things and not shutting down her state. And you had Gavin Newsom and Andrew Cuomo be absolute tyrants and continue to be it. And then you have Gretchen Whitmer, who's the worst governor in America. She's a Stalinist or a quasi-Stalinist. And she would have been a great regional governor under the USSR. She would have been terrific. And you know why? Because she's a pure and complete hypocrite. And the example this last weekend should enrage every single person listening to this and watching this, where her husband goes to a marina and he basically wants his boat to be put into the water. And his husband signed an executive order saying you're not allowed to go into the water because that's going to spread coronavirus. Complete rubbish and total nonsense. Absolute balderdash. There's no truth to that. But then he does the whole, no, don't you know who I am? My wife's the governor routine. And the people working at the marina were not thinking like, no, we're not doing this. And they publicized it. At first, she denied it. She said it's not true. She called it an internet hoax. And now she said he was joking around and I don't think it's funny. She is the absolute perfect archetypical rules for thee, but not for me, autocrat leftist tyrant. And so we have a decision to make in Western society, which is, are we going to use this as the trial run for Marxist totalitarianism that we never want to go back to? It is a time for an absolute freedom, liberty, revolution, the likes of which Western society has never seen. I'm leading it. I went all in early. I was on the front page of the New York Times, 1A. For my outspoken criticism of the lockdowns, being ridiculed and mocked by the sanctimonious leftist mob all throughout the process. But we were right. And now these people that say, oh, what's done is done. We can't hold the people accountable. No. People need to go to jail for this. There are more people that died for suicide in California than of the Chinese coronavirus. And holding China accountable is a completely different conversation, of which I'm happy to comment on. But we need to differentiate between the virus and the lockdown, because the virus infected people. Politicians shut down your life. Two completely different things.
Were you surprised by the compliance of everyone to that lockdown?
Yes. I was disappointed.
Yeah.
I said this vocally. I said, "What? Where's the outrage? We have a couple thousand people protesting. I need a couple million. Since when has America become so easy to comply with state-run autocrats that want to take away your freedoms on shaky science?" I was more than surprised, to tell you the truth. I was horrified. Brian, I was let down because this is not a country I thought I was living in. I thought we were a country where they said to stay home. They said, no, you got to prove that to me a lot beyond a shadow of a doubt, to shut down my business for me as an evangelical Christian, the most important thing in my life, to tell me I can't go to church on Easter. Excuse me? No. You don't get to do that. My rights are natural from God. I believe in a Lockean theory of natural rights that you have to prove to me beyond a shadow of a doubt with good reason every couple days in front of a judge that I can't take the blood and body of Jesus Christ on the holiest day of the Christian calendar. You don't get to do that. We created you. You didn't create me. And so I still am really let down and horrified. And I'm afraid that if they try this again with a more aggressive, better planned model, if you will, for no pun intended, that it could be the end of Western society. I hope it's a wake-up call for people, because the tyrants were really close to destroying everything that we loved. And the only reason they didn't is people actually started to protest and wake up. It's not about the modeling. It's not about the science. The only reason this started to change was the 22,000 people that showed up in Lansing and started hawking at Gretchen Whitmer, the tyrant. And she tried calling them Nazis, which was one of the most ridiculous, unfounded accusations in modern political history. You know why? The people there were calling her a Nazi. Now, I wouldn't go that far. I think that you should really reserve that. I'm just going to be perfectly honest with you. But that's not what was happening. It's a lie. They were calling you that. She said, oh, I saw imagery of things I didn't like that were from that time period of the 1930s and 40s. No, they were calling you that, Gretchen Whitmer. They weren't saying that's a good thing. They were saying they hate it so much and they hate you equivalent to that. Again, I'm not saying I completely agree with it. But left is not the left is not in pursuit of truth, and truth is not a left-wing value. And one final thing on this is, look, how many undetected cancers, how many undetected tumors, suicide hotlines overheating, anxiety medication has gone, applications from anxiety medication has gone through the roof. Opioid use is up. Marijuana use is up. Alcoholism is up. The price of cocaine is up. As bizarre, I don't know how you quite calculate that without arresting the people that are actually dealing the cocaine. That's a different conversation for a different time. This is probably going to go down as one of the worst mistakes in Western society. We need to recognize it, admit it, put a flag in the ground, arrest the people that lied to us, and make sure it never happens again.
Yeah, I think I'm always surprised by how much fear is out there. And it's probably because I'm lucky to have conversations on a regular basis here with people who don't buy into a lot of the quote unquote, science that's out there. So I have a front seat to really question what we're being told. But, I live in England, and, these are people that made it through the Battle of Britain in 1940. I mean, they were getting bombed every night right in this neighborhood where I'm at, and they still showed up. And yet I've been shocked to see how scared and frightened they are to come back to work. Now, I don't believe in surveys, but I was talking to Dave Rubin last week, and I was telling him there was a survey that it said 68% of the British public would rather lose their job than go back to work and risk getting the coronavirus. And that blew my mind that even at this late date, people would still be that scared. But it goes to show you the kind of what's been done to the people with this big, with fear, and fear can make people do things. And like you said, it has historically. So they even said something in Britain the other day. They need another campaign now to get people to go back to work after the first campaign to get people to stay home. And it just makes me wonder how ridiculous it is. At the same point, I can't have a conversation on YouTube or any other social media that even questions masks, social distancing, testing, etc. So look, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but all this stuff adds up to a similar result.
Well, and I mean, there's a highly instructive British philosopher, Thomas Hobbes. He was so right. He said, fear is what drives people in their natural condition. He wrote The Leviathan, and it was very, very informative for people. If you want to understand what's happening right now, read The Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes. He was right. He said that fear is the default position of human beings, and they will operate in that fear. It's not the pursuit of truth. It's not the pursuit of justice. And he didn't diminish those things, but rather very, very long form. It's not an easy read. But he comes to the conclusion that in the state of nature, it is fear that drives human beings. And I think he was right. I think that is so true, and that the media has fed into this. And I have to say, the activist media has been one of the most complicit, dangerous, and morally bankrupt institutions in this entire thing. They are solely responsible for a lot of the carnage. And I hope that they realize that people committed suicide because of them. I hope the media realizes that people are dead because of them, not because of the virus. People committed suicide because of the media. How is that possible, you say? We shut down Western society because of the media. Basically, people committed suicide because of that. More people committed suicide in California than of the coronavirus. All death is tragic. But I think it's rather agreed upon that suicide is something that really should bother people. Because unlike a virus, that's a voluntary exit from your existence. That's something that is very, very troubling for me. I've lost friends to suicide. I've lost family members. Extended family members, I should say. Be more specific about that. It's not lives versus the economy. It's lives versus lives. Lives versus lives. And the media will get away with it. It's time to create our own and call them out. They are not purveyors of independent truth. The discipline of journalism is dead. These are activists that want to destroy our civilization. It's time to treat them like that.
Yeah. Every time I watch anything now and read anything online or a paper, I just see fear-mongering for profits and alternate agendas, and I just see all sorts of nonsense. And yet I'm being censored.
America is ready to get back to work. But to win in the new economy, you need every advantage to succeed. Smart companies run on NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. With NetSuite, you'll have the visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. Everything you need all in one place. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in sales, NetSuite lets you manage every penny with precision. You'll have the ability to compete with anyone, work from anywhere, and run your whole company right from your phone. Join over 20,000 companies who trust NetSuite to make it happen. NetSuite surveyed hundreds of business leaders and assembled a playbook of the top strategies they're using as America reopens for business. Receive your free guide, 7 actions businesses need to take right now. It's great for anybody, whether you're a business owner or not. Go right now to netsuite.com/Kirk. Get our free guide, your free guide, netsuite.com/Kirk. Free product tour right now, netsuite.com/Kirk. That's netsuite.com/Kirk.
Let me move on. What did you think of the Trump's nightly briefings? I started posting like a minute of his opening briefings on my like Instagram maybe 6 weeks ago. I've never been very political on this show, but I found them strangely soothing. I also found them to be what I do here at London Real, which is long form conversations that are unscripted and unedited. And in where we had a vacuum of leadership in the world, I just found it admirable that a guy got up every night who doesn't like talking to the media and yet still would talk for 2 hours and try to answer questions and be himself. I don't know. I honestly miss those things, and they got me through some hard times. I don't know. What did you see?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of the modern day equivalent of the Socratic dialogues, where it's like, you can ask me anything for as long as you want, and I'm not going to back down. I loved every minute of it. And the media obviously hated it because he put them on blast and put them on notice. And I thought it was very beneficial. I miss them too. And I just loved the juxtaposition of President Trump and all the other people he'd bring up that had be so scripted. And look, the president was heroic in calling out China's involvement in lying about the virus and its spread throughout the world. The president was heroic in calling out the media and their dishonest coverage throughout the entire process. And so I'm always of the believer, the more Trump, the better. You know, there's people that want to put him in the box, and I say, no, you have a guy that has 40 years of institutional experience and instinct of how to brand, and actually more than 40 years, probably 50 years of institutional instinct and experience of how to brand and how to message, how to communicate with people. And you have been wrong about everything over the last couple decades. Why don't you just let the guy that actually got elected to president by defeating the Bush dynasty, the Clinton dynasty, the media dynasty, the tech companies, maybe he knows what he's doing. And so I'm always of the opinion that from a default position, not that every decision he's going to make is obviously going to be perfect. That would be against human nature, but his trend line is going to be in the direction of victory and in the direction of what is right and what is good. The Trump trajectory, if you will always end in a position that is good for our country. That is because he's so self-aware of the decisions that he's making. And then he has an ability to pivot and correct better than any other person I've ever seen in public life. He says, oh, this is working? Nope. Okay, well, this might be working. Okay. And whereas other politicians are so dogmatic and they have no ability to be able to self-assess, look how things are going, and then actually have an end goal in mind of what is best for our country.
Yeah, when I was watching, I kept thinking, what would a career politician be telling me right now? It would just be some scripted nonsense. And I'd be like, gosh, I'm just glad I'm not listening to somebody who's been in D.C. for 30 years. Also, it's funny to watch him because his gut says, get America back to work. And like on his right shoulder and left shoulder, he's getting this study and this. But he's thinking, no, we got to get America back to work. We got to get people, you know, it's just weird to see him grappling with that and ultimately trusting his gut. That's what I see him doing now. And that's been fascinating for me to watch. What's it like? Is it surreal when you tweet out like China virus and then the president is kind of using that term days later? Is that surreal?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm just a kid from Chicago that didn't go to college, that started an organization on campuses, and now I have the leader of the free world using the two words that I thought would better describe the virus than some silly COVID-19 descriptor, because it actually puts blame where blame is due. And every virus that we've named in the last 100 years is actually the point of origination. It's not as if this is some sort of new concept. It's like we're going to carve out the one time we don't use the geographic point of origination just so happens to be the country that owns half of our political leaders and the ruling class. That seems awfully convenient. It seems that every other outbreak, from Ebola, which I believe was a river in Africa, to West Nile, to every other virus, we basically use the place where it started. And actually, the president, I believe, based on independent reporting, found some inspiration on my tweet about that to mention that in a press conference. But yes, it's very surreal. I'm humbled by it. And even, I believe, a couple days ago or yesterday, he used the term China virus. And yeah, I just had it pulled up here on my computer. West Nile virus, Guinea worm, Ebola, Zika virus, Rocky Mountain fever, SARS, even Lyme disease, all named after geographic location, MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. And it's not racist. It's not xenophobic. And then when he uses China virus, they freak out. I guarantee you that if it would have been West Virginia virus, no one would have cared. I mean, or if it would have been the Polish virus, no one would have cared, or even the Egyptian virus. It just so happens that the one country that owns our entire ruling class and owns our media, they make a couple calls because it's making them look bad. Then all of a sudden they use the oldest trick in the book that they have. Well, that's racist. That's xenophobic. Why wasn't it racist to call it Ebola? That's kind of bizarre. And so, look, again, that's an act of the activist media. So yeah, it's awfully surreal, and it's something that I take very seriously, that the words that I put on Twitter can impact the leader of the free world.
While we're on this topic, what do you think was China's role in this, or how do you think that they should ultimately be, I don't know, talked to, prosecuted on this? And then while you're on the topic of China, you know, you mentioned that they own the media, they own half our political influence. Can you talk on that?
Yeah, I mean, China's America's greatest enemy. I've been talking about this for years under a lot of criticism and ridicule from people in the ruling class that benefit financially from China. Last year, I wrote a piece in Fox Business calling China America's greatest enemy, and I got more calls from senators and congressmen saying my language is a little too hot on China. I don't get those calls anymore. In fact, I get more people agreeing with me on that. China's been at war with us for 40 years. Maybe we should start to fight back. They deindustrialized our country. They basically shipped 10 million jobs overseas, and in exchange, we got piles of plastic that we fill our garages with that are basically useless garbage, and we ask people to take away 5 years later in garage sales. They're trying to rebuild our entire 5G infrastructure through Huawei. They built over 107 Confucius Institutes on our college campuses across the country, which are pseudo-military installations that even the highly ethical, questionable Christopher Wray has called a huge threat of China domestically, the largest threat of China domestically, where they have server rooms and CCP military officials that frequently visit these military installations on our college campuses. They build islands in the South China Sea in defiance of the international orders and our wishes. They're still classified as a developing nation in the World Trade Organization, which allows them to compromise and be able to cut corners so that they can essentially ramp up production a lot quicker than we can, while we have to be under completely different environmental standards. They have 1 million Muslims in concentration camps, which should bother the American left, which doesn't. They say that they're really worried about Islamophobia. Well, if they're so worried about that, then why don't they care about the Uyghur Muslims? I always mispronounce that, so I apologize. 1 million Muslims in concentration camps in China. China's buying up ports of entry in Africa, in South America, and it's Uyghur Muslims. I apologize. I get that wrong. I always look at it phonetically, and so it's Uyghur Muslims, over 1 million Uyghur Muslims. The Belt and Road Initiative, which is a world domination strategy in Italy and all across Europe. And so at some point, we have to realize that there's a difference. I have to say this first before I continue. There's a difference between the Chinese people and the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese people are being held hostage by the CCP tyrant, and they only represent about 5% of China. Now, that's not insignificant when you have a country that has 1.3 billion people. That's like 80 million people. So I don't want to say that that's insignificant. It's basically like two Californias. That is the CCP. But as a percentage basis, it's a minority. And so I have called for a complete and total shutoff with all trade and for us to start a new Cold War right now. It's time for a new Cold War. We shouldn't be afraid of it. We won the last one. We can win this one. We were lied to. We were lied to under this neoliberal promise that the more we trade with them, the more westernized they're going to become. That's incorrect. We were told that we could export our values to them. That never happened. We were told that the more we traded with them, they're all of a sudden going to embrace free speech, and they're going to be wearing Levi jeans and eating McDonald's and listening to Kanye West and protesting for democracy in the streets of Shanghai and Beijing. The exact opposite happened. It only further emboldened the ruling tyrants to create a social credit system and score using our tech company's technology so that they could monitor themselves through some sort of new age Orwellian 21st century petri dish experiment that they might export to the entire Western world. They've shut down Hong Kong. Mike Pompeo, who's doing a terrific job, has now called Hong Kong, no longer are they an autonomous entity or state. It's something of that variation.
Is that fight over, you think, in Hong Kong? You think that's over?
I'm sorry?
Do you think that fight in Hong Kong is over? I mean, it looks like a pretty sweeping move, this last one.
I mean, I don't want to be too dire about it, but we haven't stood with them the way we should. I mean, we shouldn't be trading with China, period, end of story. Yeah, it's going to cause higher prices and disruption in supply chain, but there's nothing they make that we need to survive. Nothing. There's nothing that we can't make here for a little bit more money. And so, for example, I did some exploring in the textile space. You can get an American-made T-shirt at cost for $3. You can resell it for $12 for the margins that are a little bit less for making in China. There's no excuse anymore. What do they make that we need? Nothing. People say, oh, we need to sell our stuff to them. Get used to lower profit margins. Maybe sell more stuff in India. I mean, or maybe sell more stuff in Southeast Asia. We are in a collision course in 40 years for a military conflict that no one's going to like. They hate us. The CCP does, not the Chinese people. I want to make that very clear. The Chinese people actually want freedom. A lot of them do. A lot of them are part of an underground Christian movement that's very promising. The freedom fighters have been waving American flags, and they have been under the thumb of the tyrant Mussolini equivalent Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping would have been best friends of Joseph Stalin, just so we're clear. And it's time for us to treat them like the malevolent force of the 21st century that we are. We are addicted to the cheap capital flow and the piles of plastic that they send us in return to America. It's either we love America or we love piles of plastic and the inflated profit margins that have been unrealistic for the last 20 years. I want our country back, and I want Western society to succeed. It's time for a new Cold War against China.
And what about the virus? What do you see that happened there?
With the virus?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what do I see happening? I mean,
I met with China, more with China and, you know, responsibility and kicking off in Wuhan and not talking to people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm cynical. China has been very strategic in purchasing the correct entities and influencing the right people in the right international organizations to prevent justice from ever happening. I mean, the Wuhan Health Organization, or the WHO, as I call it, is highly compromised because of Chinese money. So do I think they'll be held accountable? Probably not. I mean, the only person that can do that is Donald Trump. But it's not going to hurt until we put sanctions on them. So let's ask ourselves just a very simple question. And the reason I get to the Cold War analogy, and I know that might be a little bit firm language for your audience, but we basically have a cold war right now with Iran. Pretty close. We don't trade with Iran. We have sanctions on them. We do war games against them. It's pretty close. Who's a bigger threat to our country right now? Iran or China? By the way, I agree with what we're doing with Iran. I actually support it. But I think Iran is a fraction of the threat to us than China. Are you kidding me? I mean, Iran is a fraction of our population. They do not have the technology prowess. We don't have Iranian Persian institutes on our college campuses trying to influence opinion. I mean, I guess we have Muslim Brotherhood. That's a completely different conversation for a different time, though. But my goodness, my friend, China's deep within our society. And so I'm actually not a neocon either. I've railed against the invasion of Afghanistan and railed against the invasion of Iraq. And I don't believe in nation building, and I don't believe in dictator displacement. I think that the war games that Biden put in Libya is one of the worst foreign policy mistakes in American history. And I love that Trump is getting us out of Afghanistan. But I also see a collision course happening internationally and geopolitically against the new evil of our time, and that is China. And I don't want to do anything brash. I actually think us icing them out now is what will prevent war. If you love peace, if you want to avoid war, you should be committed to us standing up against China now, once and for all.
Well, that's some really interesting points. I appreciate them. We just had General Robert Spalding on the show, and he spent a lot of time in China, a lot of time thinking about China, and had some similar points. There's actually, funny enough, a show on Netflix now called like History 101, and it's got a really generic version of the last 50 years of China. But I'd say most people don't have any idea what happened in that country in the last 60 years. It's worth just kind of educating yourself just to give a different perspective on that. I want to ask you about Turning Point USA. What do you see in the younger generation and college campuses that us older people wouldn't see? Like, what is happening on these campuses? What do you do? And what are the conversations that you have with these students?
Well, thank you for that question. Yeah, it's about 8 years into it. I'm so proud of what the team has done here at Turning Point USA. I wish I could take credit for all of it, but that wouldn't be true. We're on 2,000 high school and college campuses across the country. We play offense with a sense of urgency to win America's culture war. On college and high school campuses, students that are conservative are under huge assault, under attack for having dissenting points of view and opinion, that have a worldview that is rooted in facts and logic and a historically based perspective. And at Turning Point USA, we're no longer playing defense. We're actually trying to take terrain from the left, and we're doing so with huge amounts of success. We're doing so at a rate that is really worrying the radical left. And I can tell you that the Marxists believe that their college campuses are sacrosanct, that they should not be touched by any sort of conservative philosophy, any sort of free market point of view, anything that might espouse a pro-American, pro-Western, pro-Judeo-Christian moral ethical perspective doesn't belong on college campuses. And so young people right now, we have a huge opportunity. The left is selling misery, and the left is selling hatred of our country. I think that's actually going to hit a ceiling soon of about 40% of the built-in younger population. But we got to start delivering for young people. And I was really outspoken against this last stimulus for good reason. Why are international corporations that have tons of cash reserves getting bailouts and young people are continually getting screwed? Why are we going to be issuing more visas for foreign workers when our graduates can't even find work? And I admittedly, I didn't understand, that issue has become in full color right now, where there are young people saying, Charlie, I'm not going to find a job for the next 2 years. So shouldn't we put their interests first? They got educated in our schools. They grew up in our country. They should be given preference over some person halfway across the world. That I'm not diminishing their humanity, but you have to have a prioritization. You have to have a hierarchy of needs and wants and demands. That's the whole point of living on our planet, that you have to have some sort of hierarchy of needs, wants, and demands. And so it's about time we start representing them. I'm advocating for them every single day. When you create $6 trillion out of thin air, that's a debt and deficit burden on our generation. Why are we giving money away to universities that teach our kids to hate our country that have $10 billion endowments? They change their tuition rates so high and the tuition keeps going up. I've called on the president, and I have hope that he'll do this, that he says that there should be a tuition freeze for the next 2 years. Freeze tuition. That's a very basic deliverable. And so we have an opportunity to win students over. They're cynical and skeptical of debt forgiveness and Medicare for all and all that garbage that is being peddled by the left. It's time for delivering results for a generation that is getting screwed by the ruling class.
Why are these, when you say like college professors are anti-American and they hate America, like why would a group of people feel that way about the country they live in?
Well, it's true. Not all of them. I mean, there's some good of them, so I should nuance it a little bit. But it's generally true. I mean, look, I've done a lot of thinking about this, and I've probably visited more college campuses than anyone on the circuit in the last year and a half. And I obviously represent a organization that is the voice of young college campuses, young students on college campuses, I should say. So first of all, you have to look archetypically at these professors. A lot of them are deeply unhappy people personally. They just are. And they don't have a sense of place in the world. And the only place of belonging they have is not rooted in delivering results, but instead delivering revenge. It's rooted in this deep resentment. They want to transform the world around them. They don't actually have gratitude. A lot of them are ingrates, which means that you have ingratitude for what is around you. They don't believe America has been a force for good. They don't believe the American experiment is something to be appreciated. They think American history is dark and tragic and something that should not be studied and passed on to future generations. They don't look at the sacrifice of our veterans and our amazing individuals that built our country from nothing as anything that is admirable or righteous or true. They want to fundamentally transform something, and you don't fundamentally transform something you love. And we learned that from Barack Obama. I mean, you don't go to your wife, or you don't go to your girlfriend, or you don't go to the person you care about and say, I love you so much. Now I got to fundamentally transform you. I mean, that would be silly. It would end the relationship immediately. You fundamentally transform that which you don't like. You fundamentally transform that which you don't see eye to eye with. And so on a final point is this, these professors are, they see themselves, they have a messianic complex. They actually see themselves as saviors of the world through the vessels of their students to create a youth-led revolt to topple what they consider to be unjust. They consider themselves to be the saviors of the planet. If you don't believe me, just ask them. Some of them will even admit that they consider themselves to be a piece in the jigsaw puzzle, a part of the tapestry of the downfall of Western society. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, why do we keep supporting these institutions that teach our kids to hate America, that don't equip them with the skills to be able to succeed in our country, and also are so exorbitantly expensive that we have an entire generation in debt, and therefore they're more likely to embrace socialist principles? This is awfully self-defeating. And 13% of Americans have a graduate degree, and they're the ones that run this country. And they don't reflect the values of the rest of the 87% of Americans. And I don't want to overly generalize. There's plenty of good professors and plenty of good people that have doctorates. What I'm saying is 90% true. And therefore, it is worthy of the type of language I'm using to describe it.
And you've said whatever happens on college campuses will soon happen in the halls of Congress. And the leading indicator of culture is what happens on college campuses. There's a lot of power there because you're sculpting these young minds. And that's really what we're seeing, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, this entire shutdown was basically them trying to turn America into a college campus. You can't say anything you disagree with. Stay in your home. We'll keep you safe. And they try to turn your apartment into a safe space. I mean, the college campuses was a dry run for the American shutdown. And that's why so many young people were okay with it. They were okay with it because they were conditioned to believe that this is something that's desirable. They were conditioned to believe that the nanny state, the professor, the administrator, the social justice warrior, behavioral counselor is the one that's going to keep you safe from the outside world. And Jordan Peterson calls this the Hansel and Gretel archetype. Come on, I'll keep you safe. I'll get you fat. And when in reality, they're getting ready for you to be totally exploited and destroyed. I just hope, similar to the Hansel and Gretel story, we wake up in time and are able to revolt against the people that are doing that to young people. And look, Jordan Peterson was so phenomenal about this because he spotted stories like that because they were written as warnings to society for a reason. And so none of this surprises me. I mean, people say, Charlie, were you surprised? And I did say earlier I was disappointed, but when I'm actually honest with myself, if I believe my thesis, which of course I do, that college campuses are a leading indicator of the culture we're going to be in, that they're a harbinger of things to come, they're a canary in the coal mine, then we ought to be awfully serious that if we continually send our most prized possessions, our young people, to anti-American indoctrination camps, what kind of country do we think we're going to live in? I mean, they're anti-Socratic. They're anti-Western. They don't read the great books. They don't even equip you for the job market. They don't teach you that there's anything such as objective or absolute truth. They don't even teach you to be ready for the outside world. I mean, the university is a place where you're supposed to learn dissenting and opposite opinion. The university should be the anti-safe space. And here's the interesting thing. We say, well, students don't learn history. Well, that's pretty obvious because there's nothing safe about learning history. Do the thought exercise of imagining yourself of being in the position as one of Stalin's henchmen. That's a pretty dark place to go. That's a thought exercise that can bring you to the darkest levels of humanity. There's nothing safe about that. It's awfully instructive for a young person to do it, but they don't want you to go through that because it's actually pushing the boundaries of what might be safe. And so now we have an entire culture in the early 20s and mid-20s and early 30s students, young graduates, I should say, they're the ones that have been most supportive of the shutdown. Coincidence? No way. It's a corollary. They're the ones that have been conditioned to believe that this is a good thing.
It's a very interesting perspective, man. I'm going to meditate on that. Talk to me about the book, MAGA Doctrine, and your relationship with Trump and his ideas. I mean, as late as the 2016 Republican National Convention, I think you openly said that you weren't necessarily sold on Trump. And yet for the last 4 years, you have gotten to know him very well, his sons and his doctrines. And now you write this book. Can you tell me about that whole evolution of who you are?
Yeah, of course. Post-convention, I was all in for the president and I traveled the country with Donald Trump Jr. and I put a lot on the line and I was heavily criticized for my advocacy of Trump during the 2016 election. I traveled nonstop with Donald Trump Jr. I fetched his diet Red Bulls and his diet Cokes. I took his selfies, you know, with him. And
what made you want to do that? Like what?
I'm sorry?
Like who were you in 2015 and what made you make that switch at the convention to go all in on them?
I want to be very clear. I don't think it was a switch. I was for Ted Cruz. I was for Governor Walker as someone who was a doctrinaire three-prong, you know, three-stool conservative. And I was never anti-Trump, but I was skeptical that a businessman from New York that once donated to Planned Parenthood was going to be the greatest pro-life president in American history. The convention comes. It becomes abundantly clear those of us that love America have no choice. So I go all in, like many conservatives did, and I advocate vociferously for the president and for what I believed he was going to deliver for the country. And he wins in a surprise election. And you have to understand that during that 2016 election, going as all in as I did for President Trump post-convention came at a price. I mean, I was getting calls from people saying that I was making the biggest political mistake of my life. And not you, but other people say, well, Charlie, you weren't all in. And I say, yeah, it's well documented I was advocating for Senator Cruz. But it's equally as documented that I spoke at Trump's convention and I traveled the country with his son for 100 days at a huge expense to my credibility at the time of which I had, you know, whatever I had at the time. And then we won. And then I got to know the businessman, Donald Trump. And then I got to see what made him tick. And then I got to look at him in the eyes. And then I got to travel around with Jared and Ivanka and Eric. And I saw a sense of urgency for them that I hadn't seen from anyone else before. And mind you, this was 22, 23-year-old Charlie Kirk, okay? And I saw a sense of urgency from the Trump family that said, the country's on fire. We believe that we can be part of a movement to save it. And I loved that. I was all in. We won. And then my advocacy and my commitment to the president doubled, tripled, quadrupled to exponentially when I started to see a guy that every decision he was going to make was under this matrix. What did I say? And that's what I'm going to do. I said, oh my gosh. I've never seen anything like this before, especially for someone at the highest levels of the American government. And I talk about this in the book quite honestly of how the president then all of a sudden became the most conservative president for those of us that care about the lives of the unborn, those of us that care about our Second Amendment rights, those of us that care about immigration, those of us that care about that. All of a sudden, he started to check those boxes in a way that no one else could and fight for the forgotten man and woman and bring dignity to the middle class. So I write about this in the book that there's a doctrine behind this, that there's a philosophical base for it. And the book has done unbelievably well. It was number one on Amazon for a couple days and we couldn't have dreamed that happening. And the reason being is, and the reason I wrote the book is I was watching some of these cable news shows, and I was watching MSNBC, and I was watching CNN, and I was tired of people telling me what the president believed. I said to myself, you hate him. You hate everything he stands for. Why are you telling me what he believes? I actually have gotten to know him. I've spent time with him. I've traveled with him. That's not what he believes. His modus operandi is our country is being screwed by a group of bipartisan elites that don't represent the best interests of America. I'm going to try and fix it. That's the story of the MAGA doctrine. And he's done a phenomenal job of it.
What's he like behind the scenes?
He is the most honest person I've ever dealt with. He's magnanimous. He's wicked smart. He's hilarious. He never forgets anything. And he's the most, one of the most generous people I've ever dealt with. He always asks me, how can I help you, Charlie? Most politicians, it's the other way around. They're almost begging, hey, can you offer something for me? For the president, it's like, how can I help you, Charlie? What do you got next? Is there an event I can speak at? Is there something that, you know, I need to know about? And then that's the other part of it. He's incredibly inquisitive. He treats me like a subject matter expert. A kid from Chicago who never went to college that started the grassroots army on 2,000 high school and college campuses, he treats me with as just the same amount of respect as someone in their 70s with a PhD from a college campus that's been studying something as specific for years. And so that to me is something that is worthy of unbelievable respect. And my loyalty is very, very well documented to the president because he's unlike any political leader I've ever dealt with.
And yet most of the media would convince you almost the opposite of everything you just said about him. And they make him out to be almost the opposite of everything you just said.
Well, they've never met him. And that's the other thing is that the media, we are now trusting our description of a leader of the free world of people that have never spent extended time around that person. And isn't that amazing? And that's why I wrote this book. I said, look, I haven't served in the White House. I haven't, you know, but I've spent more time with him than most. And I don't like trading on that. I actually don't like talking about it very much. Because there's so many people that have made that kind of like an industry thing. And I think it's kind of gross, to be honest with you, because I think a lot of that should be kept in confidence. And I think a lot of that you're trusted with it. But now I feel compelled to defend him when people say that he's all these awful things. I say, have you had a meal with him? Like, have you had one meal with this guy? And if you haven't, shut up. Because I have, and I know the truth, and you don't.
Is he going to get reelected?
Yes. And I paused because I don't like making huge commitments because things can change so quickly. But as things are today, yes. I mean, obviously, I'm going to work my tail off to make sure that happens. And I say yes because of who he is and how hard he is to defeat and his commitment to being able to adjust in real time, and also who we're currently running against. I have fears, though. I have fears that they're going to make the most brazen attempt in voter fraud in American history to try to defeat him. I have fears that the tech companies are going to try to get in the way and alter him from being able to get his message out. And I have fears that the media is going to turn into a complete and total multi-billion-dollar propaganda arm of the Biden campaign.
Right. So those are still very real, those possibilities. Because when you look at when you look at Biden, you think, wow, this isn't much of a competition, but it really isn't about him, is it? There are so many other forces at play here.
No, it's not Trump versus Biden. This is such an important point. It's Trump versus their entire infrastructure. It's Trump versus the leftist machine. And so it's Trump versus the left. It's not Trump versus Biden. It's Trump versus the deep state. It's Trump versus the bureaucracies. It's Trump versus the editorial room at CNN. It's Trump versus the moderate Republicans in Kennebunkport, Maine, and other undisclosed locations that hate him so much that they would much rather a Biden presidency than Donald Trump. So it's Trump versus the power system. And it's not Biden is just a puppet. I mean, he's in fact, we should actually be honest. We should be thankful that he's so easy to attack and he's so mentally transient that actually the representative of that very malevolent and dark power system is someone as flawed as that. I mean, we should be thankful that they didn't nominate a Manchurian candidate style Brad Pitt that is so well coached and telegenic that represents that entire power system better. The fact that it's someone as corrupt and unpredictable, I'm going to be very nice right here, unpredictable as Joe Biden, who tells people that they're not black if you don't vote for him, that's a blessing from God, quite honestly. Like Barack Obama is my point I could use. I mean, Barack Obama is right out of central casting. I mean, if Barack Obama wouldn't have been president, he would have ended his career and he would have starred in a Universal Studios film. I mean, the guy's got a smile a mile wide. He's very good on camera. It's like Gavin Newsom prior to his decibel level sounding like Bane from Batman, where you can't listen to Gavin Newsom without just whatever happened to his voice. Anyway, that's a side issue. But we should be lucky. So, yes, it's Trump versus the left. It's not Trump versus Biden. And it's even more than the left. It's all the systems that are behind that. It's this interlocking machine. And we have an infrastructure too, but it's nowhere near that. Oh, my gosh. It's nowhere near that. But the one thing that we do not have, we have two things they don't have, the people and truth. And because of that, I hope we win.
Let me ask you a question. Let's say he gets reelected, but then 4 years from now, there's no Trump. There will probably never be another Trump. You know, then what happens? I mean, there's nobody that will ever be able to fill that type of role and go head to head against China. And like you said, be this anti-dogmatic guy that you talk about in the book. What happens then, Charlie?
Well, so there's two ways that this can go. This can go back to the traditional Republican technocratic view that we're just going to be people that run government better than you. And we're going to go back to the endless war, kind of a China appeasement Republican style philosophy. I'm not convinced that's going to happen because I know the base of the Republican Party quite well. And now that they've had a taste of what a populist revolt can be, they're never going to go back. So it might not be someone as magnanimous and someone as articulate and someone as unique as Donald Trump, but I don't think these issues are going away. I think that restrictive immigration, fair trade deals, being firm on China, the restoration of the middle class, the challenging of the eight wealthiest counties around Washington, D.C., this is here to stay. And someone who is vocally pro-life, I mean, this whole nonsense that we have to not talk about social issues, that's never going to happen again. Good luck. That works great if you only want to represent the interests of Malibu and Manhattan. But there's people in Missouri and Montana and Michigan that are worried about the lives of the unborn, that are worried about the confiscation of guns, that are worried about the deterioration of free speech. So I don't worry too much about post-Trump, actually. I don't, because he's been such a profoundly impactful philosophical divergence from traditional Republican orthodoxy for the better. Absent something that I don't see, anyone trying to fill the old void of we're just going to have corporate tax cuts and that's somehow going to win us the election, I don't see it going back.
In 2024, you're turning 30. What is Charlie Kirk doing at 30? Like, what do you want to be doing with your life? Is it still Turning Point? Have you done other things? Have you moved on to other arenas?
I want to be happy. That's important. And so whatever I'm doing, look, I found two things that I absolutely love. I love running Turning Point USA and impacting the hearts of young minds. That's never going to change. And I love what I get to do on the podcast every single day. I love it so much that we're going 7 times a week, probably more so than almost any other podcast out there. I could say in the political, literally every single day we post a podcast. I don't see myself changing from that. I love the idea space. I love being able to bring people from the brink of the left. I love being able to bring people to Jesus, which I get to do here. We have so many people that are leaving secularism and being able to reaffirm their religion because of us. I'm happy. I want to stay that way.
I had Candace Owens on the show a couple weeks ago, and she mentioned you when she was talking about the Me Too movement. And she says, Brian, I was one of the first people to come out and say I wasn't buying Me Too. I felt like it was the left that were hijacking, that were kind of weaponizing this issue. And she said, when I came out, Charlie Kirk had to stand with me, and I was with Turning Point, and he did. But she said he took a lot of heat and they took a lot of heat for backing me for that point of view. But in I think she made her point when it all kind of played out. Is that how you remember it? And was it difficult? And what are your thoughts on Candace?
Candace is an American hero. One of the things I'm most proud of in my life is my association with Candace Owens and how we were able to kind of go on this. I'll never forget it. It was the Wild West of American politics. And it was so fun because she was just coming on the scene. It was during all the most heated accusations of Trump being a racist post-Charlottesville. And here comes this unbelievably powerful voice, Candace Owens, that starts going to college campuses, gets the attention of Kanye West, and builds this unbelievable platform. She becomes our communications director at Turning Point USA. She's very kind to say that, and I thank her for that. And it's true. I mean, she came out against Me Too and saying this is going to be weaponized in a factless, baseless way to go against innocent men. And this was a couple days before our Young Women's Leadership Summit. How convenient that was. And I stood by her, and so did our whole team at Turning Point USA. And there was a price to that. And, you know, we had the Times and the Post and the Huffington Post come after all of us brutally because of that. But we stood by her, and she's been terrific. And I thank her for those comments. And she's very kind to remember it. And obviously her platform now, I mean, she's a super weapon against the left. That's what she is. I mean, we now we have in American politics someone that has a following, has a voice, has a charisma, has the work ethic that they could never have imagined. And so I'm immensely proud of what she's been able to create and do, and what she's doing at Blexit might be one of the most moral movements in American political history to give black people the confidence to leave the American left and the Democrat Party. And so any way I can support her and reaffirm her, and I'm just proud to be able to say I knew her when, and I worked with her at the very at the beginning stages of her political career. And it's something that I will always treasure for the rest of my life.
Yeah, she's not afraid to bring out the big guns when she needs to. I mean, you know, she'll fire big shots over, and she has recently on her social. And I'm just impressed because she doesn't have to do that. She's got a big following, and she sticks to her guns and goes for it. And yeah, I've been impressed. do you have another book planned, or do these things take a lot out of you?
Can you say that one more time? You came in a little bit static.
Do you have another book planned, or are you taking a break after this one?
I do have a couple books planned right now that I'm working on, ideas, thesis statements. Books are tough. I just want to enjoy this one. We worked our tail off. It performed very, very well. It hit number one in so many categories, still doing really well, and better than I could have imagined. The president has endorsed it repeatedly. So I just want to kind of be thankful, and there will be another book, and it will be something that I think will have a very, God willing, a profound impact on the American and international zeitgeist.
Well, it's The Mega Doctrine. I'm guessing people can pick it up on Amazon, and maybe also your website, which you can let us know about. Also, The Charlie Kirk Show, top 15 among political shows on Apple iTunes. What's the best way people can get more info about all this stuff?
Yeah, they can go to charliekirk.com, or they want to get involved with Turning Point USA, tpusa.com. If they want to buy the book, that's awesome. If they want to subscribe to The Charlie Kirk Show, hit it in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and that would be a huge blessing to us.
You know, Charlie, I always ask my guests a question at the end, and I always say, you know, what advice do you have to that 20-year-old that's listening to us or watching us somewhere in the world? You know, they're growing up in a different kind of world than I grew up. What do you tell people of that age when they're being bombarded with lots of different information? They're on a college campus where they're being pulled this way and that way, and yet they also can tune into shows like yours or ours and hear different points of view. What advice do you give them?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. Thank you for asking it. Two things, and I could go at length for a 20-year-old right now that I think is really important, which is try to ask yourself, what does it mean to live a good life? And do your best to do that. This is something that the Stoics would talk about. Instead of just wondering what the world should look like and good or bad, those are very important questions. You and I do it all the time. Be a good person. And that act will actually give you a deeper level of fulfillment. And that goes to the second thing, which is that discipline can actually give you a tremendous amount of freedom in your life. And the more disciplined you can be personally, the higher level of flourishing you can succeed to. So what do I mean by that? Maybe you should decide to wake up every single day at 6 a.m. Try to exercise every single day. I'm a big believer that motion is directly related to emotion. And so for young people out there, it's a tough environment with all the digital noise and all the disruption that this lockdown has caused because of the virus and our reaction to it. But I could go at length of the type of advice I would give, but I think that we need to be much more serious about what it means to create good people and stop making excuses about what might possibly get in your way to your level of flourishing and your level of success.
Love that message. We've had Jocko Willink on a few times, so we're big fans of discipline and freedom. So I appreciate that. The book is The MAGA Doctrine. It's an excellent read. I encourage everybody to pick up a copy. And Charlie, thanks for your thoughts on the censorship issue. Honestly, you brought some new perspectives. And I've been super lucky to have you and Candace and Dave on recently and just give me, you all have very different thoughts on it. It just gives me more ammo that I can talk about and utilize here kind of on the front lines. And, you know, thanks for being a part of this. I appreciate you.
God bless you. Thank you so much.
What a fun conversation that was. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. It was really a treat to be able to air a conversation that I'm actually the one answering the questions, not asking the questions. Make sure you guys are subscribed to The Charlie Kirk Show. Type in Charlie Kirk Show, your podcast provider. Hit subscribe. Leave us those 5-star reviews. Thank you so much for listening today. And email me your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com. And the first 5 people that email me London Real gets a signed copy of The MAGA Doctrine. Leave your address in there. We are sending out hundreds of free copies of the New York Times bestseller, MAGA Doctrine, and we want to keep on sending them to you. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. God bless.